Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. Michael Pollan is our guest this hour, and we are going to get very excited about cooking. And the book is an important one. Let me highlight what I think is a major part, a political focus of this book. Michael writes, as long as we let corporations do most of our cooking for us, our agriculture will continue to be dominated by giant monocultures of grain and animal factories. Big companies only know how to buy from big farms, and it means the movement to build a more diversified and local agriculture can develop only if people are willing to buy from those farms, and they'll only do that if they are cooking. So Michael has written a book about cooking. It's not just a book about cooking because it's, you know, the history, and he found some wonderful people that he could be an apprentice to and learned about different aspects of cooking. The latest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. And he, of course, has written many other very, very important books. The Omnivore's Dilemma was the 2006 book that looked at the ways that we source our food and, as one reviewer has said, became a kind of Bible for the slow food, eat local movement. This one, he looks at food in his family, how he learned to cook, the importance of cooking in all aspects of our lives in terms of how healthy we are, our bodies are, and how healthy our families are, because think of the importance of food in the family, and yet we only spend 27 minutes a day on average cooking. So why do we do that? Well, Michael's here, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot of phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. He's written a number of other books. I'm sure many of you have read them, Food Rules, In Defense of Food, The Botany of Desire, and he is also the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley. He has been, how's this, to be named one of the 100 most influential people in the whole wide world. Time magazine named him that. Michael, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Very good to be back on your show.
Yeah, great to have you here. I'm so hungry. I was thinking...
Me too. The way you talk, I want to eat.
I do too. I'm thinking about my lunch, and I'm sure that you will influence what I have for lunch today. You know, as I was reading about you and your mom and how you grew up, and I grew up this way too. My mom always prepared. It was because it was the mom's job to do this. We had fabulous food every single night of my life. I don't ever remember going to a fast food restaurant. I remember food on the table, and she thought about it, and she cooked it, and it was terrific. And you grew up that way too.
Pretty much, although my parents would sometimes go out on Friday or Saturday night, and then we'd get TV dinners, which didn't mind either.
Yeah.
But yeah, she, you know, Monday through Friday, basically she cooked, and there was a rotation. It was very predictable. We'd know which night we'd have pasta and which night we'd have steak or hamburgers or meatloaf. And she really cared about cooking, and that time, not just at the family table, but in the kitchen, watching her cook, you know, taking in those smells, watching those transformations take place, you know, those are among the most powerful memories of childhood. And I think a lot of people have those memories, although I worry about this next generation, you know, being robbed of that experience, because it really is priceless.
Is it true that we only spend 27 minutes a day cooking now?
That's the average, and it's fallen by half. Ooh. 1965. It's fallen precipitously, and we spend 4 minutes cleaning up on average, which strikes me as a signifier that maybe we're not really cooking if we're only spending 4 minutes cleaning up. That sounds like you're, you know, wadding up packaging and throwing it out. So,
right.
But yeah, that's the official numbers. That's what the marketers work with, 27 minutes a day. And oddly enough, you know, a lot of people watch TV cooking shows, which last longer than 27 minutes. So there are millions of Americans who are spending more time watching other people cook on television than they're spending cooking themselves, which is a kind of a bizarre situation.
It is bizarre. And as you remind us, we say, oh, we're so busy, we're working, we're picking up the children, we've got all these other events, we can't possibly find time to cook, and yet we spend how many hours a day behind screens?
Well, we spend outside of work, we spend about 2 hours a day surfing the web, and we've only been doing that for about 10 years, and somehow we found 2 hours for that activity, and which tells me that, you know, we manage to make time for the things we think are important. And we just don't seem to think cooking is that important. And in a way, that's my goal in this book, is to help people to see not only how important it is for your health and the welfare of your family, but how interesting it is, how mm-hmm. pleasurable it is to go back to the kitchen and all the good things that follow from making a little bit of time in your day. You know, we make time to go to the gym. We understand it's important to our health and our sanity, and I would argue that cooking is just as important to our health and to our sanity.
You also, and we can put this in a sentence and take this in the many substantial areas that you take everything, to cook or not to cook, you write, becomes a consequential question, and you remind us of that in a huge way in this book. It is very consequential.
Yeah. Well, in terms of your health, it's probably the most important thing you can do, and that sounds weird because we think of health in terms of, you know, eating the right nutrients, eating the right foods. But if you're cooking, that will pretty much take care of itself. You know, unless you're the kind of very unusual home cook who makes Paula Deen's recipes, most of the things you would be likely to cook are real food. And the key to health in diet is simply eating real food. And, you know, and the reason for that is that if corporations are doing most of your cooking for you, you've got a problem because they don't cook very well. Hmm. They use the cheapest possible ingredients they can get, and then they dress them up with salt, fat, and sugar to make them acceptable. And then they have to use lots of food additives of various kinds to make it look fresher than it really is, because this stuff all has to stay on the shelf for months at a time. And they're using chemicals in their food that, you know, no normal human being ever has in their pantry, and chemicals about which there are some real questions in terms of our health. So, you know, unless corporations surprise us and really figure out how to cook well, how to cook with care, how to cook with your health in view, the only way we can take control of our diet and make sure we're eating what we think we're eating is by having a human cook for us or cooking ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw that picture. It was circulating, I think, yesterday on the web of a McDonald's hamburger that was 10 years old.
No, I didn't see it. How'd it look?
Well, it looks just like the McDonald's hamburger that you would buy today. So you wonder what in the world was in that had it stay about the same for 10 years.
Well, we do have, there's a lot of synthetic food out there. You know, I bought a loaf of Wonder Bread when I heard they were going out of business. And that happened in November, and this loaf of bread is still as soft as the day I bought it.
You're kidding.
And it is now, what, April? That takes some pretty sophisticated chemistry, and I guess they're to be complimented on having figured that out. But it gives me the willies.
Well, you wouldn't be the writer that you are and concentrating on so many aspects of food. You must have done some cooking in your life, but you really took it a step up here. Can you tell me what you did, what you concentrated on in writing this book, how you broke food down?
Sure. Well, you know, I had cooked. It wasn't like I was a complete ignoramus in the kitchen. We made dinner more nights than not, but it was not something I put a lot of time or thought into. We usually just grilled something on the grill, something very simple, and you know, maybe roasted some vegetables in the oven and called it dinner. And mm-hmm. it was something I seemed normal and not that special, and I hadn't approached with much thought. When I decided I wanted to really dig in, because this was the link in the food chain I hadn't yet dealt with as a writer, except passingly in Omnivore's Dilemma, where I do cook a meal that I'd hunted.
Yeah.
I realized at a certain point that this middle link might well be the most important one, for the reasons you discussed at the top of the show, which is that what happens on the farm is strongly influenced by whether we're cooking or not. And as you said, big companies tend to support industrial agriculture. The reason we got industrial agriculture was, by and large, as Eric Schlosser demonstrated in Fast Food Nation, to feed the appetites of the fast food chains. I mean, they're the ones who really drove the revolution of our agriculture and took it down this industrial path. And so the way we prepare the food has a huge bearing on the kind of agriculture we have. And then looking the other way, it became clear that as I studied nutrition for In Defense of Food and food rules, that the best predictor of a healthy diet was whether you cooked or not. And that was, you know, we have a lot of studies that suggest that people who cook eat much healthier diets. Even poor women who cook have better diets than rich women who don't. And normally the quality of the diet is connected to your income level. Mm-hmm. But cooking completely undoes that effect, which I thought was very significant. So once I decided that, you know, here's this last link of the food chain, I really need to, if I'm going to complete the picture I've been drawing with all these books over the last 10 years, I need to look at these at cooking. And I decided, as I usually do, is to get back to basics, to drive cooking down to the very, you know, it's very kind of basic elemental structure. And that turned out to actually be the four classical elements. That there were, that as I looked at the whole issue of cooking, there were four basic transformations into which you could divide anything you were cooking in any culture. The first was fire. The oldest and simplest kind of cooking, discovered as much as 2 million years ago, before we were actually even Homo sapiens, when we were still Homo erectus. That was a tremendous achievement for our species, and in fact changed the course of our evolutionary history. Because as soon as we learned how to cook food, we unlocked this amazing store of nutrients that other animals don't have. Because when you cook food, you don't have to chew it as much. It's much easier for your body to break it down. And you can eat all sorts of things that you can't eat raw, like cassava and various tubers and things that are actually toxic if they're not cooked.
Mm-hmm.
So the discovery of fire and putting fire on food led to this incredible expansion in energy available to the human brain. The human brain grows much bigger than in any comparably sized ape, and the human digestive system grows much smaller because it's not needed as much. So there's a trade-off in evolution between a big gut and a big brain. And we went down the big brain route and the smaller gut route, although we do seem to be trying to enlarge the gut again.
Right.
But, but basically, that was our that was the trade-off that allowed us to become human. So cooking really made us who we are as a species.
So it made us smarter.
It made us smarter in so many ways. And you know, if you look at apes our size, they spend something like 6 hours a day in the act of chewing, because they have to, you know, digest all that raw plant material, and it takes a lot of work. And if you see a great ape, that's what they're doing. And, you know, if you're chewing 6 hours a day, it doesn't leave a lot of time for culture, for music, for radio, for books. It's consuming. And so you could argue that cooking gave us culture, too. It certainly gave us civilization in that it led us to meals. Hunter-gatherers, you know, would pretty much eat on the run wherever they found the food. And once you're cooking over a fire, you need to cooperate. Someone has to tend the fire. You have this big animal that has to be, you know, shared. And then you need all the rules that come with sharing a big, delicious piece of meat. And then there's the conversation that, you know, that breaks out around around right. mealtimes and fire. So fire is a huge development for our species in so many ways. And we've understood this. We've had myths, you know, Prometheus and other myths of the discovery of fire. But it really is not just heating us that was important. It was heating our food or cooking it. And then the other three transformations, to be a little more brief about it, is the next one is water, which is cooking in pots, which doesn't actually happen until about 10,000 years ago. And that transformation is a big deal, too, because that now allows us to eat all sorts of plant parts that were too hard to digest, mm-hmm. such as grain. I mean, you really have to boil grain slowly. And It allows us to soften food so that we can feed old people without teeth and young people without teeth. So it allows for the earlier weaning of children, which is a big deal, and it allows civilization to keep old people alive, because it used to be if you lost your teeth, you were that was it. You weren't going to be able to eat. So so that was a tremendous advance also. And then the third transformation is air. And this is the most peculiar sounding one in a way. But in fact, we like to put air in our food, and it does interesting things to it. And bread is the great example. Bread is 80% air.
You love bread.
I do love bread, and I love learning how to bake it, which I was so intimidated by. You know, I always thought bread was the kind of rocket science of cooking. You know, you needed
right.
to have precision control of your technology, and there was the mystery of the yeast, and I just seemed way beyond me. And getting comfortable though with dough and learning how to bake has been one of the most satisfying things. And learning about the history of bread, which, you know, kind of recapitulates the whole history of Western civilization. It's so important. For most of Western history, bread made up about 50% of the diet of most people. And now we worry about gluten. Anyway, and then the fourth transformation I call earth, and that is the transformation of food by means of microbes. No heat at all, fermentation. And we've got pickling, you know, we have sauerkraut and kimchi and all the different vegetable ferments, which have been, you know, in every culture, they've been very important. Because in the time before refrigeration, fermentation was the chief means of preserving food. Basically, when you ferment food, it acidifies. And those lactic acid bacteria protect the food from rotting. And so that's, you know, they found fermentation pits full of fermented taro roots that are 300 years old and still, I don't know if they taste any good, but they're still edible. at least some people think they're still edible. But fermentation also gives us cheese, which is fermented milk and yogurt, and it gives us that great blessing of humanity, alcohol, which is fermented sugars and fruit or honey or grain. So the last section is all about the arts of fermentation. And in each case, I found a master. I found a great teacher, somebody who was a really good craftsman at one of these transformations, and I apprenticed myself to that person. And I had this wonderful and the book is really the story, the narrative of my education, and what I learned along the way.
Michael Pollan is our guest this hour, and his latest book is The Omnivore's Dilemma, is part one of the books that he did previously that led to this book, which is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael's going to be in Milwaukee, too. We should tell you the Oriental Theater this coming Monday, April 29 at 7:30. It's a ticketed event, so if you'd like more information, Boswell Books, our friends at Boswell are bringing him in. Go just find them on the web and you can get tickets. It'll be a terrific evening, I'm sure, because he's so interesting and smart, and we learn things from him. It's always good to learn things. To your phone calls, there are many of them, and we have some emails coming in. Our number, keep it in mind, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always go to our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where you can get information about Michael's appearance and leave messages about cooking and food. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Michael Pollan, starting with Don in Wauwatosa. Hi, Don.
Oh, hi. Good morning, and pleasure to talk to you. I read a quote, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which I think pertains to what you're talking about, and it's from Michael Berry, Wendell Berry, and he said, "Cooking is an agricultural act." Which, being an old farm kid as I am, it reminds me that you farmer, they always said, you dumb farmer. And I always argued that, well, farmers aren't so dumb. They got to know all the kind of things that Michael's talking about. But the fact is that we're all farmers in that sense. and that we all have not only an eating interest in food, but we are by our nature farm people, and we have to deal with that. So your comment.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The only thing I would correct is the actual Wendell Berry quote is eating is an agricultural act. But I would agree with you that cooking is even more so an agricultural act, because I think the cook has a little more control over where the ingredients are coming from and a little more awareness. As an eater, sometimes it's hard to see the links between the farm and the plate. But I think that the cook, because the cook understands very quickly that the quality of the farming directly affects the quality of the food you're putting on people's plates, that cooks take a very strong interest in agriculture and indeed have helped to inspire this renaissance of local agriculture going on. You know, going back to Alice Waters, when she was starting Chez Panisse in Berkeley in 1971, she was looking for a taste that she couldn't find in American produce. Because it had been industrialized and there was a lot of indifferent farming going on. And she found it in certain farmers, many of whom happened to be organic. So there was a case where cooking led directly to very positive changes in agriculture. But, you know, that line of Wendell Berry's is very important because he's connecting the dots in a way that Americans broke the connection for many years. We had such a forgetting in our society that agriculture is at the very basis of our health, at the basis of our civilization, and we demeaned farming in many ways deliberately. I mean, there was we had a 100 years or so of having a deliberate policy to shrink the size of the farm population because we wanted workers for the factories. And because the government found farmers politically troublesome, particularly in the great state of Wisconsin, with the Grange movement and the Progressive movement.
Yes.
And, so there was an effort to shrink the farm population and take away farmers' powers. And I hope we'll see the reversal of that, because I think that more and more Americans are waking up to the fact that, you know, we ultimately depend on farmers for everything.
But for all of that to happen, as you so eloquently state in your book, we have to cook, or that movement will not grow. In fact, that movement may diminish. Can you tell us what impact the fact that we eat out a lot, that fast food is still dominating our diets, what impact is that having on a local agriculture movement, Michael?
Well, I think it limits its growth. I mean, if you go to the farmer's market, you know, you realize what's going on there. You're buying ingredients. There's not a lot of, you know, you might find some jams and things like that, some pies, but basically you're finding raw ingredients, and you really can't take advantage of a farmer's market if you're not cooking, if you don't know how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that happens in these markets is that more of our food dollar ends up in the hands of the farmer when we cook. When we buy food that's been industrially prepared, your typical dollar of spending on food, 90%, 90 cents of that goes to somebody other than the farmer. The person making the packages, you know, the cardboard manufacturer,
wow,
the cellophane manufacturer, makes
right,
more than the farmer in that dollar. Mm. So, but when we buy ingredients from farmers, either at CSAs or farmers markets, the farmer recovers more than 90% of the food dollar. So you see, if we're going to revive our farming, we need more people. It's not going to work in every case, but we need more people willing to buy ingredients directly from farmers and cook them.
Right.
And so I think it's critical. I mean, I think this movement, which is one of the most exciting developments in America right now, and it's growing very quickly, local agriculture, but I'm afraid it's going to top out if the culture of home cooking continues to decline. I don't see that large fast food chains are going to be able to figure out or have any interest in supporting small farms. There are a couple exceptions to this rule. Chipotle, the Mexican food chain, has been trying to source their pork locally in many, many places and having some success. But it's just a huge headache if you're a big company. You know, you don't want 1,500 pork contracts. You want two or three.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The transaction costs alone are very expensive. And now we see, you know, Whole Foods is trying hard to buy locally, and but it's a project, and it ends up getting very expensive for them and for their consumers. So I think, you know, if we're going to have industrialized eating, we're going to have an industrialized agriculture. And if you care about that, well, there's another good argument for cooking.
Thanks, Don, for your call. Carol is next in Madison. Hi, Carol.
Hi, is this me?
It's you. Hi.
Oh, okay. Yes, I'm curious to know if Michael has ran into any folks that are actively trying to regenerate the skill of cooking. I deal with a lot of people at local food pantries, and when we have like really nice, good, fresh produce and things like that to offer, often folks don't have a clue what to do with them.
Yeah,
or
remarkable.
Even as far as making basic, basic things like cornbread and beans from scratch, and not from a can and not from a mix. Have you come across any kind of, you know, effort to re-educate people on how to cook and how much money they can actually save cooking for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible how economical it is to cook. You know, people talk about the fact that the food movement is elitist and a lot of people can't afford it. If you know how to cook, you can do very well eating, from the farmer's market, even meat from the farmer's market, which is very, very expensive. Because if you have technique, you can buy cheap cuts and make delicious food. You can buy, you know, pork shoulder instead of pork chops or lamb necks or, you know, all these odd cuts that are wonderful when they're slow cooked, but you just need to know a little bit of technique. Yes, the answer to your question is yes. There are a lot of people who are coming around to the recognition that the loss of skills in the kitchen is really impeding people's ability to eat in a healthy way and to eat economically. So actually, if you go to my website, I put up a resources page about cooking. It's michaelpollan.com, and pull down the resources menu. But we found some really interesting projects city by city, and we listed a bunch of them. I think that the pantry issue is a very interesting one. I've heard this before that, you know, there's this emphasis on getting fresh produce into food pantries, which is a very good thing. But there's a tremendous problem, and a lot of the produce is rotting in people's refrigerators, basically because they don't know what to do with it.
Right.
I know I was just talking to someone last night in New York who's starting a mobile kitchen to teach cooking in underserved areas. We've got programs in San Francisco and Berkeley to teach people cooking. And, of course, there are wonderful programs in some of the schools. The Edible Schoolyard, which was started by Alice Waters and is now kind of franchised around the country, is an effort to teach kids how to grow food and then how to prepare it. And ultimately, I think we're going to have to bring back something like home ec, a non-gendered home ec, a home ec for boys and girls. When I went to school, only girls took home ec, and
mm-hmm.
one of the reasons we killed it off was that it was discriminatory in a way. And but I think there's the chance now to build a non-sexist culture of home cooking. My son does not have this idea that cooking is women's work. I mean, he sees me in the kitchen, but he also sees these chefs on television, these celebrities who are these macho guys, and they're totally into cooking. And so I think that there's an opportunity to build on that. That's one positive thing you can say about the cooking shows, is that they glamorize macho cooking. And maybe that'll help get some men into the kitchen.
My mom always used to say to my brother and me, the best chefs in the world are men. Did you know that? She said it over. She must have said it almost every single day. And guess who became the cook in the family? My brother.
There you go.
You know? Yeah.
She had the right message.
Yeah, she did. You
although
also,
I don't know if it's true.
You also include some links to cooking videos. These are great. This one sounds, I haven't had time to look at it yet, making meals from Clara, a woman in her 90s from the Great Depression.
Wonderful. She's 94, and she does these YouTube videos, and they're remarkably simple. and they unfold slowly. You have to slow down a little to enjoy them. But there's one of her making dandelion salad from her lawn, and it's a beautiful video, and she talks about cooking in the most beautiful way.
Oh.
Yeah, she's 94 and I think about to become an internet sensation.
Oh, great. Carol.
But YouTube is a very good way to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find if there's a particular skill I need to master, like, I don't know, folding dough or something like that and making bread, there's often you can search and find exactly the right 3-minute video. There's a great Jamie Oliver video on how to properly slice an onion, things like that that are really useful.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good way to learn, I think, with food. I like to be shown things. You know, here's how you do
Me
it.
Me too. I have a lot of trouble going from photographs in a book to actually doing a physical maneuver. I just don't have that coordination. But if I'm watching someone on a video, I will learn much more easily.
I'm with you. Carol, thanks for your call. Cassie in Shawano. Hi, Cassie.
Hello. I wholeheartedly buy into what you're saying, Michael, and I believe in, you know, buying fresh produce and getting away from all the mega farms. But as a single woman, I find cooking for myself to be a real bore. So I'm wondering, you know, what kind of suggestions you have for people like me?
Well, cooking for one is really difficult. I agree. And I think one of the problems with cooking and the reason so many women did turn away from it beginning in the 60s, 50s and 60s, is that we had ghettoized it. And that cooking alone is not like, you know, it used to be multi-generational. People would cook with their mothers and their sisters. And so getting other people in the kitchen with you makes cooking a whole lot more interesting. It's like the perfect time for conversation, it seems to me, is in the kitchen. And so if you're alone, I don't know. I mean, I still cook one even when I'm alone. If my family's away, I still will make a meal. I might simplify it a little bit. But I also find when I do that, I have a tendency to pick up the phone and call someone and invite them over and say, you know, I'm whipping up a pot of chili, you know, are you free tonight?
Uh-huh.
Just because cooking implies meals and meals imply other people. So to the extent you can make it more social, I think you might enjoy it more and you know, get someone over to cook with you when you're making dinner. Or what some people do is they'll get together. A couple people get together on an afternoon, a Sunday afternoon, and together whip up several dishes for the week. And then you just put them in the freezer or in the fridge, and you've got it covered. And you don't have to come home from work when you're really tired and start from scratch. So there are these cooking, they're sort of like cooking clubs that are sprouting up in a lot of cities where individuals can come and either you rotate homes or sometimes they're done in, you know, restaurant kitchens and things like that.
That's a great idea.
And I think getting the solitude out of cooking can be a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if Cassie has a garden. You're a big gardener. You have been, and you have been for most of your life. I think it also makes a difference if you live by yourself. You go outside and pick the things
You can be inspired by what's growing. Or you can be obligated by what's growing. Sometimes you go out there and you say, oh, God, I got to figure out something to do with that zucchini.
Right, right.
Or it's going to take over the house.
Right. Good luck to you, Cassie, and have somebody over for dinner. It's a good idea. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, to your guest. I look at the generation that I grew up with in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and all of us grew up very, very healthy, but we all grew up with good food. And I think it's just getting hard to find food that isn't processed. And my mother raised a big garden. And we literally lived off that, and I do the same thing today. I put in a good-sized garden. I can it up during the summer months, pretty much. And most of the generation I grew up with are in their 70s, sometimes their early 80s, and everybody's healthy.
Well, I think you're onto something there. I mean, I think the move from, you know, from home-cooked food, from real fresh ingredients, to highly processed food has been devastating to our health. And there are very good studies to back up the fact that as we cooked less, we gained more weight. And as we cook less, we started eating different kinds of food because corporations cook different stuff. They cook labor-intensive foods made from cheap ingredients. The French fry is the classic example. French fries are too much trouble to make at home more than once a month or so. It's just a mess, and you know, nobody likes cooking them more than, you know, you have to let enough time go by to forget the whole mess and what you did with the oil.
Right.
But corporations can cook French fries so well that that you'll eat them twice a day, and many Americans do eat French fries twice a day. So you see, there's something built into the nature of home cooking that will gravitate you toward eating real food that is healthy. And having a garden and cooking, I mean, obviously these are part of the same process. That's the same beautifully short economical food chain. And if you do have a garden, you will. It does oblige you to cook in a wonderful way. I mean, you know, in the summer when things are really going and I'm thinking maybe we should go out tonight, and I take a walk through the garden and say, no, we can't do that. We're gonna cook what's here. There's some beautiful produce. You know, I think processed food, we know processed food has been really bad for us. It's just got too much refined carbohydrates, too much fat, and these additives that, you know, I think the jury is still out on several of them. I've been working on a piece about the microbiome, about the you know, the ecosystem in your gut, and and a lot of the scientists I talked to raised real concerns about food additives as being damaging to that ecosystem, and we've never tested them for that dimension. So I think, and a lot of these microbiologists who know a lot about gut health stay away from processed food.
Michael Pollan is our guest this hour. Michael's latest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. It's a good one, as all of his books are. We should also remind you that Michael will be in Milwaukee, actually, at the Oriental Theater in Milwaukee on Monday, April 29 at 7:30 in the evening. It's a ticketed event, and if you'd like more information, Boswell Books is bringing him in. Just Google Boswell, and you can find out more information about that evening. More phone calls momentarily. Again, our number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to Tim next in Madison for Michael Pollan. Hi, Tim.
Hi, my name's Tim, and I own 9 delivery restaurants throughout Wisconsin, and I've had this idea for the last 3 or 4 years about how to get fresh food from the farmers of Wisconsin into people's homes, and that would be to maybe coordinate with some organic farmers in the neighborhood, have them put together their produce. I would pick it up, or they could have it delivered, and then I could personally deliver it, or my restaurants could deliver it to people's homes. Because people are just so busy now, they don't have time to go out and get good food. But if it just showed up on their doorstep, they might take the time to, you know, cook it up and enjoy it. What do you think?
I think it's a good idea. I've heard of similar schemes going on around the country, and I think that is one of the things that gets in the way, especially in homes where both spouses are working all day. If you add in the shopping step on top of the cooking step, it can really be too much. And there is a time crunch in America. There's no question. We work really way too long. One of the earmarks of American economy is we put in longer hours than other people in other industrialized countries, and we pay the price in terms of taking care of ourselves. I think if you can make it as easy as possible for people to get fresh produce delivered, all power to you. It sounds like a great idea.
It sure does. Thank you, Tim, very much for the call. Greg in Lombard, Illinois. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show, as always. Thank you. I'm going to show my age. I went to junior high, at the 8th grade in 1959, and we had shop, the boys had shop, and the girls had home ec, and it was a two-semester system. But what we did was you were required to rotate. So the boys did metal shop and wood shop, and then the other 6 months, I'm sorry, 4 months, whatever it was, we did home ec.
Great.
And it was a great way to learn, and the girls got to learn a little bit about making wood stuff and metal. I think that was a great concept. I'm sorry that, I guess the way education is today, if it's not testable, we don't teach it. But I think we lost a lot with that. I really do.
I couldn't agree more. In my school, we had shop and home ec, but boys took shop and girls took home ec. It wasn't a rule, but that was the culture of the place. You just had to be very secure in your 8-year-old or 10-year-old masculinity to for a boy to ever take shop, home ec. There was only one boy in the whole school who ever did it, and he was considered pretty eccentric. So I think that was a real mistake, at least in New York State, where I was. But Wisconsin, of course, has always been a more progressive place.
Well, I wonder how many home ec shop classes there even are now in high school. Probably not many.
They're vanishing, and it's really a shame. And what the caller says, it's true. If something is not testable, we don't do it. Yet, look, we are teaching health. We teach kids about safe sex. We teach them about drinking and drugs, and we take class time to do that. It seems to me that cooking is as important to their long-term health and well-being as those subjects. And if you want to do something for the long-term health of a child, teaching them some rudimentary kitchen skills, teaching them how to roast a chicken, how to cook vegetables.
Right.
I mean, this is going to serve them well their whole life.
Yeah, it sure will. Thanks, Greg, for your call. Mary in Eau Claire. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I wanted to share the story about why we started growing potatoes. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal, and they said there were only 9 major potato farmers in Idaho, and they had to grow potatoes only as the fast food company specified and with the techniques that they specified. And with all the pesticides, insecticides, and herbicides they put in, these potatoes had to be stored 6 to 9 months before they were safe to eat.
Ooh.
And the article concluded by saying all the farmers had their own potato patches next to their home. They wouldn't eat the stuff that they grew.
Well, you're right. And I actually think
we grow our own potatoes. We grow a lot of other stuff, but it was like, that's when I went and ordered the potatoes.
Huh.
Well, I think you read that in a book called The Botany of Desire that I wrote, because I told that story. but maybe it got picked up in the Wall Street Journal. But it's true. The potatoes in America have come down to russet Burbanks, because those give you the longest French fries, and those are the only kind that McDonald's will buy. The problem with russet Burbanks is that they're subject to certain diseases that make them give them little brown streaks, and it's a harmless disease. It's called net necrosis, but McDonald's will not accept it for aesthetic reasons, and so you have to use some very toxic chemicals to keep that off the potatoes. And they are so toxic coming out of the ground. These are systemic pesticides that they have to be stored for 6 weeks or 6 months to off-gas, you know, kind of like a new carpet or new furniture, to off-gas all those chemicals before people can eat it. There's something wrong with this picture, and it's a very good reason for growing potatoes in your own garden.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary, so much for your call. Chris in Madison, hello.
Hello there.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is about the shop and home ec programs, and in Wisconsin, we do have thriving home ec, now called Family and Consumer Science, ag programs, agriculture programs, teaching high school kids about growing food and other things, and also woods, our shop, also called, now called Technology Engineering Education. So in Wisconsin, at least, we do have thriving programs for high school students in those areas. Anyhow, so I just heard that while I was waiting and thought I'd comment. My question is, I'm a home cook. I'm a full-time working mom. I cook everything from scratch. I do have a garden, so I grow my vegetables there. So I don't need a CSA for vegetables, but we've been purchasing a fruit CSA that is not local. It is organic, but it comes from around the country. So we're supporting organic farming from fruit, but we aren't supporting local produce. So I just wondered what your opinion is about supporting CSA versus supporting locavore, you know, fruit, and am I really doing a service as far as making that choice with my CSA?
Yeah, I do. You know, I'm not a fanatical locavore. I think you do it when you can. And even if you just buy, you know, a little more local than you used to, you're doing something important for the local economy. On the other hand, you know, where you live, getting good fruit may not be so easy. And if you're supporting organic farmers in other places, I think that's important too. I mean, we do what we can. We do the best we can, and we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And this is a perfect case. It sounds to me like you've worked out a really good compromise where you're getting yourself, you know, really nutritious, high-quality food, and you're supporting farmers both, you know, you're supporting organic farmers even if they're not directly in your community.
Here are a couple of emails that have come in. Mary from Bellevue, Iowa. My husband and I both work. We don't have schedules that allow nightly cooking. So, and you talked about this earlier, Michael, we cook up big batches of several dishes, soups, casseroles, stews every Sunday, store them in the fridge. And so they can take them to work for lunch. We grow all of our own vegetables and eat them fresh or freeze or store them and get our meat and eggs from a local farmer whose animal raising practices we know about. I'm struck with the idea that food preparation is one main part of housekeeping that kept women imprisoned in the home and peripheral to the economy for so long. Two interesting thoughts there, or three or four.
Well, you know, I think the writer is correct to suggest that, you know, you need to be strategic if both partners are working, and cooking up several things on a Sunday is a great way to go. I also routinely overshoot. I mean, I will, you know, to make twice as much, to roast two chickens instead of one is not twice as much work.
Right.
You know, it's one pan to clean, it's one process, and it saves energy too. And then you've got the makings of another meal. I think we have to reconceive cooking as not just I'm making tonight's meal, but that it's a rolling process, and try to think up dishes that roll into another meal, so that that second chicken can become chicken tacos or soup or you know, any number of chicken salad, and so that there's a wonderful book called The Everlasting Meal by a writer named Tamar Adler, a very good chef. And that's the premise of that book, is how do you cook in such a way that, it, you know, one meal feeds the next. But I always have leftovers, and, you know, I rely on them for lunches. And we all have decent-sized freezers and fridges now. So whatever you're making, especially when you're being ambitious, you know, and you're making a stew or a braise or a soup, make a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
You will use it.
That's a really good idea, because how often do we say, oh, my God, I don't have anything to eat tonight. I got to go to the stupid store after I'm done with
work.
I
love a day when I know I've got a really high-quality leftovers in the fridge.
I know. That makes for a good day, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We have a minute left, so let's go to one quick phone call. Cindy in Madison, hi.
Hi. I just want to comment, too. I'm so looking forward to reading Michael's book, and I'm reading right now The Salt, the Sugar, and the Fat.
Michael Moss. That's a very good book.
It's a very good book.
You know, it's scary about how they got rid of home ec. But another suggestion, cooking alone is very hard. I have a dog. I cook, and he eats whatever I eat, because, you know, the dog food is very controversial, too, right now. I'll take your comments off the air.
All right, Cindy, thank you.
Well, yes, we're processing our animal food, too, and that's one of the reasons all our animals have gotten so fat. And if you've got the time and the inclination to cook for your pets, that's great.
Yeah.
They're very lucky.
They are lucky. Michael, thank you so much. We'll look forward to seeing you in Milwaukee on Monday.
Oh, thanks a lot, Kathleen. Always good to be on your show.
Thanks, Michael. Good to have you with us. Michael Pollan, his latest book just released is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael is at the Oriental Theater on Monday at 7:30 in the evening. It'll be a terrific discussion, I'm sure, and you'll probably cook more and learn a whole lot. Go to Boswell Books, B-O-S-W-E-L-L Books, to their website to get more information and to get tickets. This is a ticketed event. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show, and Katie Madsen will be with you Monday at 9. Our guests will include Ron Allen, correspondent for NBC News, who's done great work from Boston recently, and Amanda Turkle, senior political reporter at the Huffington Post. Great conversations are ahead. Stay with us, and thank you for listening.